From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American politicians love to share the luster, a little piece of the stature of Abraham Lincoln. Conservative, big thinker, and editor Rich Lowry wants to put Lincoln, his ideas, back closer to the center of the Republican Party. The party could use those ideas, he says, so could the country. This hour On Point, Rich Lowry, Abe Lincoln, and the GOP. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Was Abe Lincoln a modern Republican? Could modern Republicans use some Lincoln lessons? Could we all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us in a moment. He's written and read deeply on the Lincoln era and the first Republican president. But first, joining me now from New York is Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, author of the just-released new book, Lincoln Unbound, How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream and How We Can Do It Again. Rich Lowry, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
Listen, I grew up in the land of Lincoln. Lincoln was all over my childhood, and I love talking about Lincoln, so I'm glad you're here to do it. And I want to do it at length and depth. But I'm struck here, if we could set back for a second first, Rich, and set the table. This book is addressed to the whole country, and it's addressed in part to the Republican Party, where your voice is a very big one. What's the circumstance in the GOP that you're looking to address with this sort of lesson on Lincoln? What's your message to fellow Republicans out of this book, Rich?
Yeah, well, just, Tom, in two sentences what the book is. It depicts Lincoln as the foremost apostle of opportunity in American history, traces how that played out in his personal rise from literally nothing and obscurity, and describes how it undergirded his policies and his politics. I think it was really behind almost everything, including his opposition to slavery, and then tries to draw it forward and ask what lessons we can draw from it today when
Absolutely.
I think we really have a crisis of opportunity in this country. Now, the Republican Party in particular, I just think it cannot thrive in this nation without being the party of opportunity and the party of aspiration. We saw how it works in 2012 when it is betrayed and in some respects makes it easy for people to betray it as the party of the rich and the party that looks down at the people who are struggling and
the 47%.
The famous 47%. And that's just a losing proposition. And I think top Republicans realize this. If you listen to what Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Bobby Jindal, and their ilk have been saying since the election, it is much more in a Lincolnian key. The question still remaining is, what's the policy meat you can put on those sort of rhetorical bones?
The pole star for the party has been Ronald Reagan for a long time. But you write deep in the book about Reagan and Lincoln and their different approach to government. You know, the Republican Party has included a not inconsequential stream of thinkers who don't like Abe Lincoln. And you say the other objection to a Republican claim on Lincoln is the contemporary party's libertarian bent, exemplified by its patron, St. Ronald Reagan. His view of government accorded much more with that of Jefferson or Jackson than Lincoln. What's the difference between Lincoln and Reagan, Rich?
Well, Lincoln was had a very positive view of government and was a government activist. Now, I think the key, though, Tom, is the context of the time. And a big element of his activism constituted his support for government support of canals and railroads and the like. Now, why was that so important to him? Well, it goes to back to his upbringing. When he was coming up as a child, if you didn't live close to a waterway, you couldn't get your goods anywhere. You know, if you could get on the Mississippi, you could float them, literally float them in a handmade raft down to New Orleans and get them to market.
Which, of
but
course,
before
he
the
did.
Era of the which he did and his dad did prior to the era of steamboats, and his dad had to walk back home, as many people did.
Yeah.
When you have those sort of limits, you cannot have a real functioning market. So Lincoln supported these things in order to create a market. And this was also a time when we didn't have any financial markets to speak of. There were no angel investors who were going to back such projects. There were no big industrialists who were going to back such projects. So if you're going to do something like the Erie Canal, you had to have government supporting it. So, but the ultimate end was to create a country that was more knit together so you could actually have a working market. And everywhere the railroad touched, it was absolutely transformative. And it ended subsistence farming, which Lincoln basically couldn't stand. His father was a subsistence farmer. You know, it's a way of life that is honorable and has its pleasures, I'm sure, but it also blights opportunity. And it doesn't it's not the the kind of subsistence farming economy is not a economy welcoming to people, ambitious people of diverse talents and interests. You know, there's more or less one thing you can do.
Sure.
And as soon as the railroad shows up and you're one of those farmers, you're connected to the market, you want to buy goods from the manufactured goods from the East and clothing from the East, what do you need to do to buy those? Well, you need cash. How are you going to get cash? Well, you grow your goods to sell now, which means you may not even be growing things to eat for yourself anymore because you want to grow the crops
that
are most efficient.
You're in a market, a national market, once you've got a railroad system.
So that was Lincoln's means of the end of having a more diverse and robust market. Reagan's means, I would argue, was to the same end, but it was in a very different time, and it had to do with paring back government and rationalizing government, but also to create a more growth-oriented economy where there is more opportunity and more chances for people to rise.
What's your fundamental message in all this to set the table so we can understand where you're going as we go deeper into Lincoln's history? But to the Republican Party now, I mean, you've written plenty, you know, along with others, worrying, scratching your head, looking at losses in elections. You write in Lincoln Unbound. You write, Republicans have won a majority of the popular vote in only one of the last six elections. Demographically, they're swimming upstream and in important respects feel stuck in a bygone era. What's the message out of Lincoln that you're hoping to get across to your fellow Republican faithful?
Again, that they have to be the party of aspiration. And this means much more than just tax cuts. It means much more than just being obsessed with the debt. I'm in favor of cutting the debt. I'm in favor of lower income tax rates. But that's if that's the entirety of the Republican agenda, which you could be mistaken for thinking if you listen to a lot of Republicans, especially in Congress, you're not connecting with the needs of real people out there, and you're not connecting with this crisis of opportunity, which has in part to do with something I think neither party focuses especially on, which is the erosion of what I call in the book bourgeois virtues. Okay, this isn't Bible thumping stuff. This is very basic stuff.
Live right, work hard.
Correct. You have males dropping out of the labor force over the last several decades. You have an erosion of marriage, and you don't have to get into the morality of that one way or the other. The fact is kids do better when they, all things being equal, when they have two parents, and the parents themselves do better in marriage. And so Republicans are overwhelmingly about liberty. I think they also need to be about cultural orderliness, if you will. And that's an element of Lincoln's agenda as a Whig that was very important to him.
You write, developing a Lincoln-inflected agenda for the GOP within its limited government framework is absolutely essential for the party. Rich Lowry, you're writing here. It has no future unless it's a party of aspiration. It needs Lincoln's emphasis on uplift. An economic agenda broader and deeper than tax cuts needs to engage with the struggles of the working class and do it more seriously than in ritual denunciations of elites. How do you follow the Lincoln compass to those ends, Rich? How do you do that?
Well, what I've just been talking about, and the denunciations of the elites, it's really kind of odd in this country because the elites, you know, we think of Hollywood elites who live you know, somewhat wild and unconventional lives, perhaps. But if we take elites kind of in the broadest sense, let's take the top third of the country in terms of education, which is people who have a college degree or more, they live really boringly conventional lives. The out-of-wedlock birth rate among the college-educated folks is like 6%. Divorce has been declining. It's been declining, actually, among everyone the last decade or so, but especially among these this top third. So they've kind of figured out that traditional family, and you know, a different form, and you have female breadwinners, and it is modernized, but the basic structure works and is very important for success. So at the same time, you have so many conservatives denouncing elites and the decadence of our elites. Actually, you know, the top is kind of getting this, and they're benefiting from it in a way that the middle and the lower end aren't. So I think we need to figure out a way as a society to get that message down to the middle, down to the lower end. And this is where, you know, I'm very critical of President Obama, as no surprise to you, Tom, in mm-hmm. all sorts of respects. Mm-hmm. But that speech he gave at Morehouse College was really a wonderful thing. And it's not, you know, a speech about responsibility and being responsible fathers. But that's not just a speech anyone should go and deliver to an African-American audience. It's a speech that everyone in this country needs to hear. And so I just think that's a very neglected issue on both sides.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with National Review editor Rich Lowry about the Republican Party, the challenge for conservatives now, and the lessons of Abraham Lincoln. Rich is out with a big new book, Lincoln Unbound, How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream, and How We Can Do It Again. I want to welcome into our conversation right now as well On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, who has written and read deeply about the Lincoln era, author of Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900, joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, welcome. Say hi to Rich.
Hello, Rich. Hello, Tom.
Very nice to have you.
Hi, Jack.
You here.
Welcome.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both. Rich, take us back into some of the early part of your book here, where you're describing Lincoln's fundamental messages. And you've got one where he sits down with a group of troops. This is during the Civil War. I think it's when he's up for re-election and not so sure he's going to win it. And he sits down with some Ohio troops, and he's talking about the importance of the war and what is at stake. You pull out some lessons here that surely have relevance at any time. But take us back to that moment, Rich.
It's a wonderful little speech he gave. I don't know, it must have been 2 or 3 minutes long. It's just a couple paragraphs about how what was at stake in the war was our status as a country, where everyone had an equal opportunity and a fair chance to use their enterprise and intelligence and talent in the race of life. And that's a phrase Lincoln uses repeatedly, mm-hmm. and it really gets to how for Lincoln striving was everything. And there's and one of his lines attacking slavery, he says slavery tends to take away from African Americans. Excuse, I'm not going to use mm-hmm. the language he used mm-hmm. in that respect, mm-hmm. but it takes away from African Americans the right to strive to be men. So this is just how we make ourselves human. We make ourselves men and women by making the most of ourselves. And again, this is why he reacted so strongly against the subsistence farming of his father and his family, because there was a deep contentment there. They just tended their gardens, had their food, and that was enough. And that was never enough for Lincoln as a child or all through his adulthood. And there are these absolutely astonishing letters to his stepbrother, who stayed back in kind of that way of life and was constantly dunning Lincoln for loans. And these letters that Lincoln wrote back are just unbelievable. He says, you know, look, you're not a bad person. It's just that you're an idler. And what you need to do is to get out and work, and not just work, but work for money. And, you know, this would have made for a very awkward Thanksgiving dinners, but actually Lincoln had nothing to do with his family basically once he left it. So again, striving, making the most of ourselves in the race of life was almost everything to Lincoln. And he said to those troops from the 166th Ohio Regiment that a country that preserved this right was an inestimable jewel, and that was why the war was worth fighting.
Bring it forward. I mean, how does that work with the Republican Party today, where here he's talking to the Ohio Regiment, as you say, and he's saying that this war is being fought. He says it is in order among other things, that you may all have, as you say, that you may all have equal privileges in the race of life. Is that what the GOP stands for today, Rich? How's it doing, if it does or should?
Well, I think it does. I don't think it always gets the message across. And there are a couple things. One, it helps a lot. It's not absolutely necessary, but it helps a lot, especially when you're a Republican, if you have lived this story yourself and if you have risen up from poverty or relative poverty. And it's just very hard for Mitt Romney to hit these kind of keys, given the sort of background he had. But, you know, you look at Marco Rubio's speech at that Republican convention, and it was absolutely a Lincolnian speech. So, again, I think that most people in the party realize this is where the party needs to go, that it needs to speak to aspiration, it needs to speak to the poor and give them compelling reasons why a Republican agenda would help them, even if it's not going to get them many votes, just to communicate that this is a very important priority for them. And it doesn't get you the votes of the poor probably, but it may make, you know, other swing voters more favorably and inclined to you. And I believe, unless something goes desperately wrong, that the nominee in 2016 will basically be in this place.
We heard the Rubio story, but what about the whole country story? I mean, you write and remind us. You said trends in the middle and bottom of the income distribution are dismaying. You know, people really stagnating there. Mobility, that the race of life, movement up, lower in this country now than in Europe, which we've sort of, you know, cocked our hat at for a long time in those terms. What's going on with the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. There's been a lot of focus on inequality, which doesn't bother me so much. I think it's inevitable in a free society, and it's largely, not entirely, but largely a product of globalization. You've seen the same trends in other countries that have different policies. But what bothers me and what I focus on is mobility. Are people from the bottom getting up? And you know, that's the story we tell ourselves as a country, right? That's why Lincoln's story has so much resonance. It's the up from the bootstraps ethic, and we are not where we should be in that respect. And other English-speaking countries do better than we do getting people from the bottom further up, and other Western European countries do better than we do. I have a line in the book that if Horatio Alger was writing today, he might write in Finland. And, you know, as a conservative who has so much
hard to write,
so dismissive of Europe, that's really hard to take, but it's true.
What about Lincoln? You quote Lincoln saying, "Whatever is calculated to advance the condition of the honest, struggling, laboring man," he said in 1861, "so far as my judgment will enable me to judge of a correct thing, I am for that thing. Whatever will advance the honest, struggling, laboring man." Is that what the GOP stands for, Rich?
Well, I think, one, there's been way too much emphasis on entrepreneurship. And entrepreneur is a wonderful word. It's a wonderful thing and a phenomenon. But most people aren't entrepreneurs, right? They earn salaries or wages, and they're just trying to get by and to create more opportunity for a better life for their children. And I think it really behooves the Republican Party to make it much clearer that those kind of people loom large in the party's imagination as well. Even if you're not the next Steve Jobs, right, the Republican Party cares about you. And this goes back, Tom, to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. And that means there has to be an agenda that's more than just income tax cuts, which had a great kind of populist appeal when Reagan was advocating them in the early 80s, when bracket creep was a horrible problem, when the top rates were 70%. But we don't have that kind of system anymore. And two, the debt, which, again, a long-term problem that we should focus on and take responsible steps to address, but it doesn't really hit people in their guts where they live when they're sitting around the kitchen table. So my wish for the party would be every time a congressional Republican stands up and talks about the problem of the debt, he says something about health care and how we can get more people health insurance and how we can make health care more affordable. He talks about the cost of college and innovative solutions to that. He talks about how we can improve our education system, because one of the reasons we have in the argument of education experts a trend towards inequality is that in other periods of technological change in this country, you've had education advances in education keeping up with the technology. Well, we're kind of stalling out in terms of education. So these are things that the party has to focus on as well, rather than just going back in its comfort zone of tax cuts and a focus on the debt.
Jack Beatty, join us here. What do you think of Abraham Lincoln as an avatar, guiding light for the Republican Party today, and how his messages resonate against Republican policy and Republican prospects?
Well, you know, he is our most politically protean figure, really. He's captured now by one party, now by the other. Just 10 years ago, Tom, we had Mario Cuomo on our show who'd done a book about about
Rich
Lincoln.
Quotes him, and Rich doesn't like his interpretation, but everybody
wants to
Lincoln.
That's right, and he stole him for the Democrats. Yeah. And I think that argument that he is aligned with the Democrats could begin, and I could hear Mr. Cuomo making the argument, with the Republican platform in 1860, the one that that Mr. Lincoln ran on. It had a rivers and harbors bill to fix up rivers and harbors. It had a Pacific Railroad bill. It had a Homestead Act to open up the West and deal with the question of wage labor. It had a tariff, a protective tariff for American industry. It had land-grant colleges. All of these, and it's the motto, one of the slogans of the campaign was, vote yourself a farm, vote yourself a tariff.
That sounds irresistible.
Irresistible. Give me that tariff. But you know, all of those measures had been around in the 1850s, pushed by Whigs and then Republicans, and a party had said no to all of them. That was the Democratic Party, the Southern dominated Democratic Party. Either the Congress had voted them down, or Democratic presidents Pierce and Buchanan had vetoed them, and so you had a party of no to what the Republicans said was the sort of a program of economic development for the 19th century. And it all, sort of the guiding idea of it was a phrase of Lincoln's, the fostering hand of government. Well, today, which party believes in the fostering hand of government? I just don't see that with the Republican Party there, because it ideologically feels that everything is better if you just leave it to the market. Well, of course, rivers and harbors couldn't be left to the market. Pacific Railroad, Homestead, Tariff, Land-Grant, none of those things could have been left to the market then. And the Republicans were for them then. And, a Democrat could argue it's much more congruent with the positive government program favored by Democrats since FDR.
Rich Lowry, would Abraham Lincoln be a Democrat today?
Well, first of all, Jack, I mean, those are excellent points, and that's the best way to state the counter case to what I'm arguing. What I would say in response to that is most of those things, I mean, it's not as though Republicans today oppose infrastructure, right? It's not as though Mitch Daniels Mitch Daniels in Indiana said, let's have no roads, right? He cut a deal with a private company to run toll road and make it better and improve it. I think Republicans object to the idea that infrastructure spending should be used as a means of short-term economic stimulus. You know, we just had a huge stimulus bill in 2009, and what is the great project that resulted from it in terms of our infrastructure? Well, nothing, because they just tried to push as much money out the door willy-nilly with no thought to whether these projects were actually productive or not. So my rejoinder fundamentally would be, this kind of government Lincoln was talking about then is more or less uncontroversial today, and it was prior to the era of the welfare state. So you didn't have big transfer programs from some individuals to others, which is the main thing the federal government does today. You didn't have the bureaucracy. You didn't have the regulation that makes it so much harder now to build things. One reason we can't name a big major project is because if you want to do something quickly, you can't have a big major project because there are going to be so many layers of environmental review. There are going to be so many lawsuits holding it up. And Jack, I do go out of the way in my book to say, look, it's 150 years ago. We can't say how Lincoln would have reacted to all these phenomena and the new form of government we have today. But I just have a hard time seeing those kind of regulations blocking things, how that wouldn't have been anathema to someone who's so thrilled to the development of the country.
Jack, how about it? if he was a very, very long-lived man. I mean, he's famous for, in 1962, saying to Congress, as our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. Would he have changed on his fundamentals? He was very big on commerce. He was very big on the power of the markets to raise people and nations up.
He certainly was. He was. He believed in what he called the right to rise. What a great phrase!
Yeah.
And I mean, every time I see that, I feel just a kind of you just tingle of, you know, my gosh, that's what America is. And I think Rich is absolutely right there. And we haven't heard as much from the Democrats on the question of aspiration as they will want to do. And I think that is a real fault for on their side. On the other hand, what was Lincoln's temper, and how does his temper match up against that of the Republican Party today? Well, I think Rich would agree that Lincoln was the supreme pragmatist. He was a pragmatist before the philosophy was coined. He did what worked, and he dealt with his generals that way. If they weren't working, he fired them, got new ones. And that was his outlook. He was the least ideological of all our presidents. What did experience show? Let's test something. Let's see what experience shows and do that thing that is sustained by experience. I don't think that describes the contemporary Republican temper. It is a highly ideologized party. That is, it believes in principles. And if reality doesn't match up to those principles, so much the worse for reality. I can't imagine Lincoln saying, so much the worse for reality. He was a man whose genius was, both politically and as a military, you know, leader in a great crisis, to be attentive to every shift and move of reality.
Rich, what do you say to that? Ideology trumping Lincoln-esque pragmatism.
Yeah, that, Jack, also, that is a wonderful counterargument. You know you're Lincoln. I love it. A couple points that I would make. One, just on the quickly back on the economics. I mean, another fundamental economic premise of the Whigs and then the Republicans is that there's really no such thing as class conflict in a society and an economy properly conceived. They were non-zero people. They did not believe in zero-sum economics. They hated class warfare. There's that famous quote from Lincoln when the delegation of working men come to the White House, and he says, "Let not him who is houseless pull down the house of another, but build a house of his own."
Why put it in class warfare terms? I mean, the right to rise is there with or without. That's what his focus really was, wasn't it?
Yeah. So he would have not liked, I believe, President Obama's Aswatami, Kansas speech in the end of 2011. Now, on the question of pragmatism, that I think that's half right. He was a principled pragmatist, though, and I think every great statesman is a principled pragmatist. So he was willing to compromise. He was willing to take half a loaf, but it was towards an ultimate end that was fixed and never changed, which was making sure this country was true to that ideal, which will never change and was true for all time, that all men are created equal.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with National Review editor Rich Lowry about the Republican Party, the challenge for conservatives today, and the lessons of Abraham Lincoln. Rich Lowry writes about Lincoln in his new book, Lincoln Unbound. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us as well. He has written and read deeply in the era of Lincoln and its surround. His book is Age of Betrayal. And we've got lots of listeners waiting to join this conversation, thinking about those Ohio soldiers, the Ohio Regiment standing with Abe Lincoln as he describes to them that they're fighting the war, the Civil War, that you may all have equal privileges in the race of life, with all its desirable human aspirations, Lincoln said. It is for this struggle, the struggle should be maintained, that we may not lose our birthright. Let's go to Springfield, Illinois. Talk about Lincoln country. Bill is calling. Hi, Bill, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hello there. And coming from Springfield, we're steeped in Lincoln constantly.
Sure.
So for your Republican guest there, I would posit to him that the traditional right-left roles of the Republicans and Democrats have flipped since 1864, and should Lincoln be alive today, he would be a center-left Democrat. The reason I say that, for example, I'll give you one quote. I can't give you the whole thing, but in short, he says that capital is the fruit of labor, and therefore labor deserves much the higher consideration. He was in favor of dredging the Sangamon River in order to make it suitable for barge traffic. He was a champion, obviously, of the African-American community. Today, the center-left is a champion of the immigrant Mexican community. I mean, it's completely flipped. If a Republican were to make those sorts of statements in today's political, it would be primaried by the Tea Party and deader in a doornail.
Rich Lowry, what do you say? I mean, even by the time of Teddy Roosevelt, you remind us. Teddy Roosevelt, 1913, I think you quote him saying something like, you know, the leadership of the Republican Party are the most anti-Lincoln people out there. What about it? And what about now, Rich?
Yeah, again, I just don't buy it. I mean, he said both capital and labor have their rights and their roles. And look, the same sort of arguments we hear hurled about inequality and corporations and banks favoring the rich and being tools of the rich, those arguments were made exactly the same terms in some respects in Lincoln's day, yet he defended them. And the Whigs, again, just rejected the idea that there was class conflict. And Lincoln was, in fact, as a lawyer, was on retainer from with the biggest corporation in the state of Illinois, which was the Illinois Central Railroad. And again, when it comes to dredging Sangamon, they wanted to do it so you could enliven commerce and businesses could get their goods to market. That's not really a left-wing ideological goal. It's a very practical way to foster economic development. And again, it doesn't involve anything like the contemporary welfare state that the left today is so defensive of and doesn't want to reform in any respect whatsoever and seems to believe was handed down from tablets, you know, in 1935 or 1965 and can't be modernized or made anew in any respect whatsoever. And finally, the Republicans, I mean, if you look at which party favors the most kind of race-based policies, it's the Democrats. They're in favor of affirmative action. Conservatives tend to oppose it because they believe, as Lincoln did, in equality of opportunity in a race-blind society.
Jack, where are you leaning there between our Springfield caller's interpretation and Rich's?
Well, of course, it's so hard, as Rich says, to you know, just bring Lincoln up to the present without doing violence to history and to the present. And you know, yes, I think that the axis of difference, is just to return to an earlier point, is just that phrase of Lincoln's, the fostering hand of government. That was the Whig program. The Democratic program then was, we don't want an active, strong government because we are the slaveocracy, and that will eventually, you know, mean we won't be able to expand slavery. It was directly in conflict with what they wanted, so they made sure they had a minimal government. I just don't think you can get around that. The Democrats, for good and many would say for ill, are much readier to say, we're all for the fostering hand of government. We want to do subsidies here. We want to do stimulus there. We want to do, save General Motors. Over here, we want the fostering hand of government. The Republicans fear, oh my gosh, you put that hand out there and you're going to start corrupting everything you touch or most of what you touch.
Rich?
Yeah, no, Jack, you're right. I mean, and that element of the Republican Party, which isn't going to go away and I don't think should, it's a Jacksonian impulse, right? The fear of special favors granted by government to interest groups. And that's a legitimate fear. And while I'm sympathetic to Lincoln's economic program, first of all, he supported this massive infrastructure program in Illinois that was referred to as the system that literally bankrupted the state. Okay? So
he was determined.
A lot of the stuff was a mixed bag. The Transcontinental Railroad, which we all tend to celebrate for understandable reasons, was kind of like the moonshot of the 19th century. enabled the worst sort of fraud and corruption. Mm-hmm. So I think this Jacksonian doubt about some of the stuff is very important and can't be dispensed with. But the last point I would just make, Jack, though, is if we just did infrastructure and we'd have government that was like a federal government that took up about 1% of GDP in spending or something like that. Instead, we have a federal government that takes up about 24%. And again, most of that is transfer payments from some people to others. And we have no idea what Lincoln would think about that, because that goes back to what is a fundamental break in American history, both from Lincoln and from Jackson, which is the rise of the progressive movement and subsequently the creation of the welfare state.
But you write, Rich, in your own words here, you say, "We are on the path to a class society inimical to our ideals and our history." I mean, these days when people think about, you know, having equal privileges in the race of life or the right to rise, I'm not sure everybody is convinced that the Republican Party is really focused on that. There seems, you know, there's also a lot of attention to the rights and position of them that's got.
Yeah. Well, look. This is where, Tom, I fundamentally come down in the book. We have this crisis of mobility. We have this crisis of opportunity. I think the fundamental Lincolnian program should be applied to it, and I think it had three parts, more or less. I'm obviously simplifying. One, creating economic dynamism. Two, supporting education. And three, a program of self-improvement and kind of cultural orderliness, as a phrase I used earlier. Now, how you express each of those three things, what policies are best for supporting those three things, that involves a huge political and policy debate, and both sides are going to have a different take on that, and you can't with 100% certainty say what Lincoln would think about any of those policies. So I'm just talking of him in broad terms. I do think if you just take him as we found him in the 19th century, he'd be more a fellow traveler with me than with Barack Obama. We can debate that. But I do think that that Lincolnian kind of trinity is still absolutely essential today to address this crisis of mobility.
I'm sure the president who took his oath of office on Lincoln's Bible would be very ready to...
So, when they elect me, so will I, Tom.
Yeah. So will we all. So will we all. Let's get a call from Alma, calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Alma, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling as someone who was born and raised a Republican in small-town New England 68 years ago. And I've happily supported and voted for people like John Volpe, Senator Brooke. I love John Lindsay, Nelson Rockefeller. And I've watched over the decades in horror, not showing where the Republican Party's going. I feel like they've lost their heart and their soul. I disagree with the idea that they believe in ideology, because the one thing I remember when Bush was elected in 2000 was, well, at least he'll be fiscally responsible. But he took a surplus and turned it into a horrendous debt. He started two wars that he didn't pay for. And I honestly and sincerely feel like the Republicans have lost their minds. They're going for the extremist element and just winning the next election. And if it weren't for gerrymandering, they wouldn't even win the House. So tell me where the Republican Party is going.
Rich, what do you say to your former fellow Republican?
Well, there's a lot to take on there. One, both parties, there's been kind of an ideological sifting where both parties are more ideologically pure than they used to be. I mean, let's not forget that when the South was at its very most, you know, racist over the last 100 years ago and had an official system of segregation, it was a solid Democratic South that, you know, supported FDR. And the Republicans didn't begin to actually win in the South until the South began to change. So I think the caller has a problem with conservatives and conservatism. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to convince her in a 2-minute answer that she's wrong about that.
We'll let that one sit right there. But she's not the only one who's in the middle, sort of mainstream, who's wondering lately. We heard Bob Dole talking lately, of course. Jane in Haddam, Connecticut. Jane, you're on the air.
Hi there. Great topic. What I really want to hear an answer, not about what the Democrats would do, but what Lincoln as a Republican would do. Would he be aligning himself with evangelical Christians? where, you know, all of a sudden they, you know, God's in the Constitution now. And would he be, on one hand, so excited about education and we need to keep up with the rest of the world in science and math, and on the other hand, disregard science and intellectuals and always doubt their findings? Kids now look at Republicans and wonder, well, why aren't they supporting scientists? Why are they always going against the findings? So I would love to hear an answer to both those, the evangelical Christian part and the science and education part, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jane. Rich, what about those strands in the GOP lately, a religious fundamentalism and a kind of anti-science threat as well?
Yeah, so with evangelicals, I mean, the fact is Lincoln's Whigs were aligned with the evangelicals of the day. And the Whigs were the party of moral order. The Jacksonian Democrats were more the party of natural passions. And Jackson sort of represented that himself. He was a man that his supporters admired because he was a natural sort of emotional volcano who would hang you, you know, if you looked at him wrong. Whereas the Whig hero Henry Clay, who's very much like that himself naturally, but was a model of self-control and discipline and this key Whig Lincolnian word of improvement, right? The transportation projects were internal improvements, and Lincoln's discipline and Henry Clay type discipline exemplified self-improvement. And this was a broad agenda that where the Whigs were aligned with the evangelicals. Now, Lincoln himself, he obviously wasn't a Bible thumper. He wasn't an Orthodox Christian, but he was soaked in the Bible, and he was all about a program of moral reform and, again, cultural orderliness, as I put it. In terms of Republicans, contemporary Republicans turning their back on science and technology and intellectualism, I think it's just utter nonsense. And this oftentimes is a way to talk about the global warming debate. And the fact is, I think a lot of liberals are turning their backs on the science now because we now know, The Economist has written about this. The New York Times even, I think, acknowledged this the other day. We haven't really had any global warming in about 15 years, right? So that may suggest that what has been the so-called lockdown accepted science on this may need some adjustment. And actually, the climate is a hugely complicated system that we don't entirely understand.
I think we've got more going on here than just climate change as an issue when you come to science, but we'll look at it. Jack, what about Lincoln when it comes to research and science and sort of looking through a Lincoln prism at more contemporary statements, comments, postures on that front?
Well, he had a famous phrase where he talked about the fire of invention. I mean, that was really the key to economic growth, and he was in Washington, there's a building, the Patent Office. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln was, I think it was built during the Civil War. And the patent was to him that part of American life and making sure patent law worked and gave people protection. That was central to his vision of economic development. And on research, I mean, the land-grant colleges, that was a big part of that, agricultural research into the soil and what worked and what didn't work. He very much believed in all that. You know, the Alma's call, I think it was, or Jane rather, mm-hmm. her call talking about the picture of the Republicans today, you know, her picture resembles that drawn, and I wonder what Rich thinks of that, drawn by Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein, who are thought to be, at least I consider them, fairly neutral arbiters of the party. And they talk about a Republican Party, quote, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, dismissive of the legitimacy of the opposition. Is that accurate or just boilerplate, Rich?
I think it's profoundly unfair. I mean, the idea that when when President Obama was elected and took office in 2009 with the majorities in the Senate and the House, that was all just about compromise and reaching out to Republicans. No. I mean, what did they do when they had the power? They slammed their program through. What was their attitude towards the opposition that rose up? I would think a very heartening grassroots opposition, people who wanted to get involved in the politics in the first time and revered our founders, you know, these Tea Partiers. It was dismissiveness and contempt that turns out, as a matter of fact, to have somehow filtered down to the IRS, which went out of its way to give these Tea Party groups scrutiny and ask them intrusive questions that weren't asked of the other side. So I just think the idea that the right is extreme and the right is the only side that won't compromise is just complete nonsense and basically a smear.
Rich, if it goes the way you hope in 2016, are we going to hear from the candidate there about equal privileges in the race of life, a little more Lincolnian sound?
We are going to hear a wonderful acceptance speech about the inestimable jewel that American opportunity is, Tom. I have faith. I believe.
Okay. Rich Lowry, author of Lincoln Unbound, editor of National Review. Thank you very much for being with us, Rich.
Thanks so much, Tom. And Jack, thanks so much for your comments.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.